Next on this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, Chef David Guas travels back to his father's Cuban birthplace.
He started out doing this dish called langosta de enchilada and essentially started with onions, bell peppers, and celery. And, you know, then I started to explain to him the heart of our cuisine and what we start 90%, 95, 80, 100% of our dishes with. And so that's how he started this. And then he put some tomatoes in there. And then he put a little tomato puree. And then he had a lobster stock he added to it. And then he cooked that down with some white wine. And then he had, I'm thinking to myself, this is shrimp Creole. This is everything we know about, you know, so much of our food.
Then Grace Bauer and her daughter Kate discussed the bittersweet voyage that resulted in a new book, Los Angeles Classic Desserts. Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Coming up next, but first, the news.
Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week, we examine mothers and daughters and fathers and sons, all tied together culinarily speaking. David Guas gives us a look behind the scenes as he and his father traveled together to visit the family's Cuban home for the first time since 1959. Then, Grace Bauer and her daughter share their voyage of self-discovery. We'll learn how a hurricane inspired a whole new life in food. It's time to gather around the hearth and hear some heartwarming family tales on this week's Louisiana Eats. Chef David Guas brought the Louisiana Bayou to our nation's capital when he opened Bayou Bakery in Arlington, Virginia. But deep in this Bayou boy's genetic code is the Cuban heritage of his father, Mariano Guas. After Fidel Castro gained control of the Cuban government in 1959, Mariano was sent to a Mississippi boarding school, never again returning to his Havana home. All that changed earlier this year when father and son embarked on a voyage of exploration, traveling together back to Mariano's Cuban childhood home. David, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having me, Poppy. I'm excited.
Well, although you are a definitive product of Louisiana culture, you had a lot of Cuban culinary influences growing up. So what are some of those unique flavor memories from home?
Yeah, you know, I being from New Orleans, but having that background of the Cuban roots, the similarities in cuisine, as you well know, are really prevalent. From gumbo that we would have on the table or etouffee to black beans and rice, it was always sort of meshed and mingled, sort of mirroring the traditional red beans and rice. So black beans and rice were definitely a staple. We would do it more for celebratory sort of days, birthdays, et cetera. You could put in a request form. Either dad or mom would make them. My grandmother on my dad's side, who, believe it or not, go figure, was from Amite, Louisiana. She's the one that sort of had the best of both worlds, being from the state that she was from, but having lived in Cuba and raising a family in Cuba. So she was the cook. So when she came back to the States and settled in New Orleans, you know, she was the one that was pumping out the croquetas, you know, with canned tuna and making the ropa viejas and the picadillos and all the great classic Cuban dishes that are still pretty strong in my house today.
David, this is a part of the story I missed out on completely. So how in the world did your Louisiana grandmother end up in Cuba?
Yeah.
What was that about?
Well, so my grandfather was a practicing attorney in Havana and decided for whatever reason to come to the States and get his law degree. And what intrigued him about New Orleans was obviously the type of law that was taught and practiced in the state of Louisiana. So he went to Tulane Law School, met my grandmother, and then for whatever reason or however he did it, convinced her to move back to Cuba, and they got married and started a family.
Well, I know that in the late 50s and early 60s, a lot of Cubans settled in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. So did your dad grow up in an extended Cuban community?
No, it was, you know, I think that my dad struggling with the English language at first and being just literally dropped off on the front door of St. Stanislaus and, you know, petrified, obviously, and I can only imagine what he was going through. And then literally dropped there, and they went back to Cuba. They didn't even bring his brother with them. So they said, you know, you'll hear from us. You know, we'll send letters or what have you. And there was a lot of, as you know, sort of energy going on in Cuba, a lot of uncertainty. So he didn't raise us speaking Spanish. You know, it was one of those things. You know, he went to LSU undergraduate. He went to Auburn for vet school, and he was trying to be as American as possible. I think that was one of the things that we talk about today, that he wishes he had spoke more Spanish to us growing up. Obviously, being a professional chef now, I speak a lot of Spanish in our commercial kitchens, in professional kitchens, but didn't really, you know, wasn't fluent until practicing in the kitchen with the staff and what have you. So the food would be brought out for celebratory reasons. So like Christmas Eve or the day after Thanksgiving, we'd do a big feast either at my grandmother's house or at our house or at my uncle's house who lived in River Ridge. So, you know, wherever we ended up, we were always doing something very traditional to Cuba.
So in essence, the way that your father really shared his Cuban heritage with you was through food.
Amen.
And do you think that in some way, perhaps that influenced your decision to become a chef?
You know, we talk about that. For me, I took for granted the city that I was born and raised in as a young buck. That's just where you're from, you know. But as I get older and as I started doing more research on the food side and decided to choose this as a profession, you realize it's a very unique place. It wasn't one of those things I woke up one day and said, well, I'm from New Orleans. I have to cook professionally. but I was always sort of encouraged in the house growing up to make your own sandwich. We weren't waited on hand and foot. So, you know, if you were hungry, you got in there and you did something, whether or not it was smashing some bananas with some peanut butter on a piece of bunny bread or whatever it was, you were going to explore yourself and, you know, add some different ingredients to a store-bought cake mix, just create something unique and not necessarily digestible. But, you know, for me, it was about doing a couple of years at college away in Colorado. My great aunt Boo, Janice Bourgeois, who's from Abbeville, one day sort of pulled me aside because, like a lot of young people, was having a hard time figuring out what I wanted to do. So she pulled me aside and told me to pick a trade. She's like, look, there's carpentry, there's welding, there's this, there's that, there's cooking. And she was the cook in our family. So she's the one that bought my first cast iron pan and also my Dutch oven and gave those to me as gifts. She's the one that taught me how to make a roux, not my mom. And so I credit her a lot in my book and you know, just in general.
Yeah, well, David, you know, your Aunt Boo is the great tie that you and I have together because
sure.
I teach with your Aunt Boo at the New Orleans Cooking Experience, and sometimes she even lets me use her roux paddle. So
oh, wow.
I'm always very honored when she lets me get near any of her equipment. I know you know how she is about that.
Oh, yeah.
How did pastry ultimately captivate your attention?
It was by default, you know, as the accidental pastry chef. I landed a gig at the Windsor Court Hotel back in the mid to late 90s and started there in 96 and spent 2 years of the beginning of my career at the Windsor Court in the pastry department. I actually applied in the savory kitchen, and they weren't hiring at the time. They had no open positions, or so they said. And so my application just got shuffled and lost in HR. And so a colleague of my father's, a fellow veterinarian that did some relief work for him for many years. His husband was a banquet captain at the Windsor Court. They were coming over for dinner one night at my parents' house. My dad said, why don't you swing by and give Charles a chat? And so I did, and he snagged my application and brought it down to the pastry department. I had an interview the next day. And then, you know, got to work with Jeff Tunks, who was the executive chef, and he asked me to move to D.C. with him in 98 to be his opening pastry chef. One of those things, it was a good timing, good window, and I said sure, and moved to the nation's capital in February of 1998, and did that for 10 years, and started a consulting company, wrote my cookbook after Katrina, and then started to develop the concept of Bayou Bakery. You know, we do breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week, so bringing all the flavors of Louisiana and the South in general, the Deep South, to Arlington, as you said.
How did the trip to Cuba with your father come about?
you know, we have talked about it since I was a young, you know, knee-high to a grasshopper of returning to his native country. And it wasn't really a topic of discussion as far in the way of planning until my lovely wife decided to push this. She's been having in her back pocket the story for many years, a decade. You know, we've been married 13 years now. So she always knew it was something unique and something special. And with President Obama relaxing some of the travel laws this past January, we just saw a window of opportunity and started doing the research when they were here for Thanksgiving, my parents, going down to the sort of travel center for Cuba here in D.C., and learning, you know, really asking the questions. How do we get there? Can we do it legally? What do we need to do? You know, and just starting to truly do our homework.
So what did you have to do to negotiate that red tape? What's the condition of that these days?
You know, it was easier than we both thought. You know, we sort of had this sort of idea that it was next to impossible, and I think that's part of what kept us from asking the questions. And my father had to go through a little more than I did, being that, you know, he was born there. In fact, returning to Cuba, he was considered a Cuban citizen.
Really?
So he had a temporary Cuban passport. So once he hit the ground, he was considered a Cuban, which was very interesting to me, having been here for 50-some-odd years. So, you know, for me, I went and filled out paperwork and said I was a chef and said I was traveling to Cuba for some research and the story would be covered and I was going to be cooking with a local chef and made it about business. And that's truly what it was. Obviously, I don't have to write down the emotional weight that it carried, but that's really all they were concerned about, you know. And then my dad had to fill out a little bit more information and sort of show proof of residency, you know, here in the States. I don't know, I think it's 71 is the magic number for some reason, 1971. And, you know, that was it. We filed for the information, and I was given my permit pretty quickly pass, and his took a little longer. But nonetheless, was pretty smooth sailing considering, you know, what we thought we might have to go through. So that's it.
We've been talking with David Guas of Bayou Bakery. He's described finding his way in the professional kitchen as a baker. But when we come back from a short break, David takes us along on an amazing trip he and his father, Mariano Guas, recently took to Cuba in search of Mariano's childhood roots. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Louisiana-born David Guas made a national name for himself as an extraordinary pastry chef who never forgets his Bayou roots. We've been talking with David about the Cuban influences on his childhood dinner table. Now, David takes us along as he and his father, Mariano, travel back to Cuba for a recent Food & Wine magazine article. Their voyage of self-discovery changed that father-son relationship forever and has also changed David's outlook on how he's raising his own young sons today. Well, your trip was chronicled in the November issue of Food & Wine magazine, and the article was written by one of my very favorite food writers, the brilliant Mark Kurlansky. So how did Mark become involved in the project?
You know, I think Food & Wine pitched the story and had a couple of writers in mind right off the bat. It wasn't something that we were involved in, and he bid on it. So I don't know what else sort of behind the scenes took place for him to write the story, but nonetheless, I spent 6 days with Mark in Cuba.
Oh, you lucky duck. You must have learned things from Mark just alone.
We did. He's Mark is great, and I've really gotten to know him traveling abroad, obviously, in a foreign country with somebody. You know, you get to learn their their quirks and their traveling habits, and if they take siestas or if they don't, or how much rum they drink or if they don't, and how many cigars he's on. And like he said, he wanted to be the fly on the wall, involved but not involved, and he did just that. He's a phenomenal writer, as you know, and I think, you know, considering the amount of space he was given, really captured the trip. And obviously this is the beginning of a larger story, but my father and I are definitely considering and sort of counting the days of when we may be able to start planning our second trip.
And maybe there's a cookbook in here.
You better believe it. You better believe it. So, you know, the similarities. You know, I know you've studied all cuisines, and, you know, I was cooking with a chef by the name of Carlos. He had a restaurant there, a Paladar, that we cooked in, which was actually, you know, dubbed as his home as well. And he started out doing this dish called langosta de enchilada, and essentially started with onions, bell peppers, and celery, browned his lobster in the shell, pulled that off, then threw his Trinity in there, which he didn't call it Trinity. And believe it or not, I had my Holy Trinity T-shirt on from Dirty Coast.
And he That's was looking perfect.
At my he was looking at my shirt. Then I started to explain to him the heart of our cuisine and what we start 90%, 95, 80, 100% of our dishes with. And so that's how he started this. And then he put some tomatoes in there. And then he put a little tomato puree. And then he had a lobster stock he added to it. And then he cooked that down with some white wine. And then he had, I'm thinking to myself, this is shrimp Creole. This is everything we know about so much of our food. And so then I made him barbecue shrimp because I wanted to show him a dish of my native state. And so I swear he put it on the menu and probably didn't give me credit for it, but because his eyes lit up and they got so excited. So all his cooks were running around getting me all the ingredients I needed for my barbecue shrimp. And believe it or not, there's not a lot of heat in their food. So you think that being in the middle of the Caribbean and in the islands, you know, this food would be spicy, but it's really not. It's not like it's, you know, Jamaica and Haiti and everybody else that's down in that area. It's a very mellowed, one-pot type of meal. You know, tomatoes and rice being a staple and a lot of starches and yuca and things like that. And a lot of their influence is coming from Spain. So phenomenal olive oils and fantastic hams and wonderful cheeses. And so I love everything about it. I love learning about the food, and it was very close to home. So,
David, explain the sort of restaurant that you were working with the chef in, because this is one of the unusual things going on in Cuba, I think.
Yeah, it's called a paladar, and paladars were these homes that people started cooking out of and providing meals and being able to take some currency for it. And now they've sort of legalized, in a sense, they've allowed some of the owners of these homes to actually generate revenue for themselves. And so based on their agreement with the government, you know, everybody does it differently and everybody has their own agreement. But the paladars, what used to be very secretive and hush-hush, are a little bit more trendier now in Cuba than they ever have been. And essentially, one of the restaurants we went to was called Paladar La Mulata. It was run by a woman who was very proud to call herself a mulata. You know, she was a blend of different heritages and backgrounds and truly a Creole in a sense. And, I mean, it was on the door of her restaurant, which was her house. So essentially, she only had six tables in there, and it was essentially her living room converted into a dining area.
I think this is hilarious. You know, one of the things I love about it is the word paladar itself sounds like what is so popular in America now, the pop-up. So this is sort of a Cuban pop-up, huh?
And it's been that way for decades and decades. And so definitely not necessarily trendy there. I think that with some of the recent press that they've received in Cuba via Food and Wine, via Cigar Aficionado, they've sort of written a lot about these paladars and that the state-run sort of restaurants with their lavish cuisine and very Basque influence of Spain, those are sort of the ones that are on the main drag, and they're a little touristy, but the food is fantastic. But you go off the beaten path. You find these places that literally are opened only 3-4 days a week, where the woman's just cooking rice and this special chicken she's been known for 30 years. And they're special because she's sitting there serving you in her restaurant, in her house.
So who would know that the Cubans invented the pop-up?
Seriously.
Well, since your trip to Cuba, has Cuban food found a new place on your menus, either in your bakery or at home?
Well, it's funny. We're talking today It's Wednesday at Bayou Bakery in Arlington, Virginia, and our sandwich for the day is our pressed Cuban sandwich. And it's been that way since we opened the doors, but we've added to it since the article and since my travels. We run black beans and rice as a side dish, and then we also do these pastelitos with guayaba and cheese. So we do a cream cheese and guava stuffed puff pastry to put in our pastry display cabinet on Wednesdays as well. So you could come to Bayou Bakery today and have three different types of Cuban foods, from some black beans and rice to a sandwich to a pastry. So
that sounds delicious. And another thing I really wanted to know, David, is in retrospect now, how did this experience change your relationship with your father?
You know, I think that for me, knowing pretty much everything I thought I knew about my dad, you never get to see where he grew up. So, you know, you hear the stories and you know he's Cuban, and then you know what you know about Cuba as in the way of books and, you know, the food that you've recreated. But to go to Cuba, to see the front door of his home, to travel an hour and a half outside of Havana and go to his family's summer home, to see the land he played in, you know, to see where he set a wildfire with he and his brother and caught half the farmhouse property on fire, and to see him pointing, and this is where we did this, and this is where the water tower was that I fell off and broke my arm, you know, that to me was the full circle.
So he really did find the Cuba of his childhood there.
He did.
And it's really interesting. It was kind of like a time capsule, huh?
Most definitely. You know, although things were slightly moved, obviously overgrown, he got there, and when he knew it was it, he said, this is it. And he stood on the ground, and he said, this is it. This was our land. This was my property. This is where the pier was. I mean, it just, for me, going to the family, because, you know, seeing his home where he grew up was one thing. You know, he knew the street. He knew how to get there. We walked right up to the house. It was a sort of a split-level home. There was a woman living in the top and a family living down below. We were able to enter the top, which is not where he grew up. He was in the bottom level. The woman would not let us in the lower level, which was understandable. But the woman above actually was the same woman that lived above them.
Wow.
Growing up. And they had a nickname for her. They called her Babe. And Babe was still there in her late 70s and was a young woman. You know, when my father was growing up, she was in her late teens, early 20s, and her husband lived above. In fact, she invited us in, and we spent over an hour and a half in her house, which was, you know, the same exact floor plan as my dad's lower level, because it was one, you know, one home split level.
Uh-huh.
So that was pretty special. But then to go and travel an hour and a half outside where he didn't remember how to get to the summer house,
mm-hmm.
but he literally found it through a couple tries, and then he started to walk around the property, and then because there was no house there anymore. There was no, it was just literally off of instinct and knowing the coastline and the small bay that the house sort of butted up against, and he just knew that was it. That was pretty spectacular to sort of witness it all, sort of all the puzzle pieces just coming together where, you know, you got 10 pieces left and you're getting closer and closer to an image and boom, 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 and then the final piece is put in it, and then he just jumps up and down and, you know, he even took his shirt off. He was smoking a cigar, and he said, this is it, my land. And it was pretty powerful.
Oh, that is so beautiful. And, David, I know you have two sons of your own, Kemp
yes.
and Spencer. So after this trip, did this Cuban experience that you and your dad have change the way that you want your own sons to view their place in the world today?
Yeah, I think that for me, I'm focused on keeping the traditions through the food. You know as well as I do that food tells a story. It brings families together. It brings different blends of cultures and heritages together. You know, I don't need a placard saying, you know, what my family tree is necessarily. I do it through food. And so for me, we fly a Cuban flag in the backyard. They know what the flag looks like. My father comes to the house and he speaks Spanish to them because now he's trying to do that. Part of it, you know, we joke about, you know, coming from New Orleans and how we often celebrate life on a daily basis, minute by minute, because we don't know where we're going to be tomorrow. And Cuban culture is very similar. You know, they've been repressed. They've been unsure of their future for many, many years. And, you know, a good cigar and a nice rum can cure a lot. And so, yeah, it is. It's front and center, and it's very important to me to remind them of that on a daily basis.
David, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to share this very personal story with us.
You bet. It was great to talk to you, and I was happy to do it.
David Guas of Arlington, Virginia's Bayou Bakery. Ago, I had the good fortune to work on a national magazine shoot highlighting Cuban Christmas traditions. Cooking teacher and cookbook author Ana Rodriguez invited us into her Miami home for a family celebration. Cuban Christmas centers around a whole pig, butchered just for the occasion, then cooked in an outdoor roasting box. The roasting box looks much like the modern-day outdoor cooker known in Louisiana as a Cajun microwave and used to cook a cochon de lait. That clever Ana shared a recipe with me that doesn't require either a whole pig or a willing husband with a Cajun microwave. But it is a process that takes 2 to 3 days of marinating and slow cooking, so you'll have to plan ahead. The centerpiece of this Cuban Christmas dinner begins with a pork leg or shoulder. It's spiced with a dry marinade of oregano, cumin, white pepper, and salt, combined with lots of onions and garlic, and a particular kind of sour orange loved by Cubans. Although fresh sour oranges are hard to find, you can mimic the flavor by combining lime and orange juices, or just use the pre-made Goya bitter orange marinade that's easily obtainable in grocery stores these days. The pork marinates in the refrigerator for a day or two. Then, about 24 hours before the big meal, the wet marinade is drained off and the dry marinade is applied liberally to the meat. Now the roasting begins. First uncovered at 400 degrees, and then with the meat tightly covered in aluminum foil at 175 for up to 24 hours. 2 hours before it's time for the Feliz Navidad feasting to begin, the foil comes off, and the pork finishes in a 375-degree oven. By deglazing the pan with some wet marinade that you set aside, you'll have a perfect sauce for this melt-in-your-mouth pork roast. Include black beans and rice as a side dish, and you're on your way to a real Cuban Christmas with lots of time to spare for holiday fun. The complete instructions for pierna asada and the black beans recipe, too, can all be found on our website at louisianaeats.org. Buenas noches and Feliz Navidad from us all here at Louisiana Eats. Country Roads contributor, Baton Rouge-based Frank McManus, is also an authority on what and where to eat in every nook and cranny of our delicious state. Frank, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you, Poppy. It's good to hear your voice.
So tell me, where are we going today?
Well, we're going to stay local in Baton Rouge today. One of my personal favorite places that doesn't get nearly the acclaim that it should is called Ronnie's Boudin and Cracklin' House Number 2. It's over on Florida Boulevard, and it's a very sort of unassuming little spot, which in general is where you find the best products, in my opinion. The plainer the exterior, the better the things that you're going to get on the inside. There's a few things that I would definitely recommend there. They do serve a daily plate lunch, which is sort of your standard fare, whether it's a fried pork chop with mustard greens, or they'll do, you know, red beans and rice or fried catfish, that kind of thing. But they do a lot of stuff that's packaged for takeaway. You know, I've eaten boudin all over this state, and now I won't say that their boudin is the finest in the world, although it's pretty fantastic, but their smoked boudin is off the charts. It's the best I've ever had. It's just got that drum-tight skin to the outside that gives and cracks right when you bite into it, and just a tremendous richness and fullness of flavor that is hard to impart to something like boudin without going over the top. It's just beautifully balanced. Their smoked boudin is unreal.
Well, I'm a cracklin fiend. So what kind of cracklins do they have?
Well, their cracklins are another one of my favorite things that they have there, and one of the other items that's served fresh. In my opinion, theirs is only rivaled by Fatty's Cracklins in Woodville, Mississippi. Mm. But they do the thick-cut cracklins, not the ones that you see in the bag that look sort of like styrofoam packing peanuts, but the real deal where you can see the full cut of the pork belly. There's real meat in there as well as the thick layers of fat and skin, and they're just incredibly satisfying. You get them in a little paper bag that, by the time you walk out of the store, it looks like it's in danger of coming apart because the grease is starting to soak through the paper.
Yum. You're making me hungry. What's in the freezers? Have you ever taken anything home?
I have. I've taken a lot of stuff home from there. They do like a cornbread dressing, stuffed chicken. They've got cut up rabbits. They've got a variety of items like that that you can take away and cook whenever you want. They've got some really delicious ribeyes that are seasoned and in some cases stuffed. They've got some deer boudin, which is really pretty spectacular as well.
That's very unusual.
It is, because, you know, you don't get a lot of wild game that's offered for sale, but obviously in this instance, you know, it's been farmed, but it's pretty delicious stuff. And I should also mention that if you're looking for a meat to flavor your dishes, their tasso, which they make fresh there, is excellent as well. I frequently buy that, and it comes both frozen or available fresh, and it'll improve a bean dish or, well, just about anything that you can think of putting tasso in. Theirs is excellent.
Sounds great. So last question, Frank. Was there a Ronnie's number one?
You know, I've always wondered that, or if there's a Ronnie's number three somewhere, but I've yet to be able to track that down. I know that it's been in operation for close to 20 years now, and like a couple of the great gas station boudin houses of South Louisiana, they've gone through a couple of incarnations, as I understand it. So that might have something to do with the way that it's named. But it's definitely worth a visit if you're in Baton Rouge and you like hogshead cheese, or you like boudin, or you like tasso, or you like cracklins. It's definitely the place to go.
Well, thanks so much for taking us high on the hog today, Frank.
Thank you, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Frank McMahon.
It ain't the meat, it's the motion. Make sure daddy wanna rock. It ain't the meat, it's the motion. It's the movement that gets the sock.
We'll be right back with a story of a Louisiana mother who teamed up with her daughters to completely reinvent her life. Grace Bauer was once a successful international interior designer. Now, she's an equally successful cookbook author. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are people who preserve and protect our state's delicious culinary position on the world stage. This week's hero is a New Orleans native who's been a familiar face on public television for over three decades. Our hero has relentlessly worked to record food memories from chefs, food producers, and enthusiastic eaters alike before they vanish into forgotten history. Researching into the wee hours of the morning, our hero hunts precious bits of local ephemera, often using eBay to acquire menus, posters, and even china and silverware from long-lost Louisiana restaurants to visually help bring them to life for her audience.
Well, TV is such an intimate medium. That's the big thing. You're close up and you're personal. And so I really am very touched by personal stories. And last year, this is gentleman Kenneth Palmer who talked about who grew up very, very, very poor and a single mom, single parent, and like, you know, six kids. And he talked about his aunt's Japanese plum tree and fig tree and hanging out the whole afternoon eating these fruits. But just, you know, it's the fruit of the land, Poppy, in New Orleans. You've got the bananas. We have banana trees in our backyard. We're about to have grapefruits. You know, it's just the bounty of the land and those childhood memories that are associated with those kinds of things.
Having produced over 25 historical documentaries, with food being a strong presence in virtually everyone, in 2011, our hero was finally honored with an Emmy for her documentary, New Orleans Restaurants with a Past.
Well, it's a great mix because I really, really, really like New Orleans history. You might have noticed, okay, if you watch Channel 12. But also, we all love to talk about eating, and we dine out a lot. And so what better way to mix those two? But I've been fortunate the way the stars have aligned that we've been able to really focus on food. What happened was about a decade ago, we did a show called Lost Restaurants of New Orleans. And that show, we did 37 restaurants. And let me just say, to quote Becky Allen, it was hard, hard, hard. Because if you, most people, unless it was for a birthday, he didn't take pictures inside of a restaurant. So it was quite a challenge, shall we say, to find stuff since it's TV in terms of visualizing these restaurants that we all remember fondly. But anyway, that program is one of those programs I've gotten really the most amount of response to.
That's why Peggy Scott Laborde is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Congratulations, Peggy. And thank you for preserving our Louisiana Eats collective culinary memory. Just a few short years ago, neither Grace Bauer nor her daughters imagined that a new career for Grace as chef and cookbook author was about to transform their lives. Grace is here with her publicist daughter, Kate, and Grace's first book, Los Angeles Classic Desserts, to explain how that all came to be. Well, Kate and Grace, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you. Thank you, Poppy.
Grace, like so many New Orleanians, your transformation really began with Hurricane Katrina. So what happened to you and your family at that time?
Well, fortunately, our residence was not damaged, but the city was so badly damaged that we had to leave. And we kind of scattered, and I ended up in L.A. to visit another daughter that had just had a baby. We thought that would be fun. We'd go for a few days. So my daughter Leah, my daughter Kate, and I, and a grandchild, all headed to L.A. for what we thought would be a short visit. And that was 7.5 years ago.
At the time, you had a whole nother career in business going, didn't you?
That's correct. My business at the time was commercial interior design. And I had been downsizing the business, but we still were quite active. But the staff ended up scattered after Katrina, as did I. And so putting that puzzle back together got to be a little challenging, and I found myself with extra time. And also, returning to New Orleans wasn't as easy as I thought it was going to be. So I ended up staying in L.A. I still come back to the city. I'm, I guess you'd say, a bi-coastal resident. But anyway, I ended up with a little extra time there and was intrigued with the Cordon Bleu Culinary School and decided to do that. And that sort of led me on a kind of interesting path.
Had you always secretly wanted to be a chef?
Oh, I always loved to cook. I always did a great deal of entertaining. My grandmother owned restaurants, and she was quite a cook, and that was her livelihood. I'm one of seven children, and we ate at home every night for dinner, and so you had to be a good cook.
And where'd you grow up?
Here, New Orleans.
So you are a native New Orleanian.
Oh, yeah, I'm a New Orleanian, absolutely.
Kate, what did you think, you and your siblings, when you heard that your mother was going to be a chef?
Well, first we thought that we probably had to up the exercise game because we knew that a lot of food was going to be coming home. But we were absolutely excited. I mean, we had had dinners at home as a family, all six of us growing up. So that's sort of what we knew. And so it wasn't really that far-fetched that Mom was going to take on a whole new career. And being an entrepreneur and starting an interior, a very successful interior design company, we really had complete faith that she would take this to another level, which she did.
When you set out to study cooking, what did you envision doing with this?
Oh, Poppy, when I started out doing this, this was, remember, a sidebar to my design business, and I had the time. I would certainly not tell you I had a grand plan, but things happen in life. You know, you put one foot in front of the other, and the path sort of takes you along. So, no, it was not a grand plan. It was just a very fortunate set of circumstances.
Well, it's fascinating because that kitchen, that professional kitchen work, is so incredibly demanding. And one of the biggest bustling, busy kitchens that really put out a lot of food here in New Orleans is where you interned. I hear you were at Arno's. How did that go?
That was absolutely busy. You're right about that. And when I started there for the externship, it is the largest restaurant in the city. But I got there and they said, what do you want? I said, I want to learn everything. So I ended up working with all the departments, the saucier, the pastry chef. I did off-site for a golf tournament. I did the line cooking and some banquet, even a wedding. And it is, when you're behind the line and that line is going and those tickets start coming at you, it's amazing. And I make a point now when I go to a restaurant, if the food is really good, I make a point of telling the waiter to please tell the cook the dish was very good.
Everybody needs a little appreciation from the chef all the way down to the dishwasher. And Kate, were you and your siblings watching your mother do this amazing physical work? What did you all think?
I don't know if we were watching her directly at Arno's, but I mean, she would come home with with amazing dishes that I guess we were very excited to try, and that she was proceeding actively this culinary lifestyle.
Well, actually, Poppy, I'm just going to add to that. One of the things that got me intrigued was, as part of my externship, I did some test cooking for Kit on some of the books she was working on.
And so, of course, you're talking about our mutual friend, Kit Wall.
Kit Wall, I'm sorry. I just thought everybody knew who Kit was. But anyway, yes, so within this test cooking situation, we would have all of this wonderful food for the, I think at the time, the seafood book, and it was heavenly. And so you couldn't throw it out. I mean, you just had to bring it home, and it was really wonderful.
Well, tell me about the process of how you went about choosing and gathering these recipes.
Oh, Poppy, that was a real challenge because Los Angeles is so huge. And when you look at the greater L.A. area, you have over 26,000 restaurants.
26,000?
Right. And it's a small book. You're looking at 45 to 50 recipes. So what I wanted to do was present the city in entirety so that people could understand what LA was about. And it's very complex and a lot of ethnicities, and there's a lot of history there. So we looked at some of the old restaurants like the Brown Derby, and we put that in. But then we wanted some of the newer, you know, places. Knott's Berry Farm is in there, and Disneyland. But we also realized that LA had a lot of other things that were very popular, like the bakeries. And La Brea Bakery is there, and Sweet Lady Jane's. And so it's kind of a mix of old classic restaurants, great new restaurants. Wolfgang Puck is there, Mario Batali with his new restaurant. So we included the new contemporary cooks and restaurants and the old classic ones, and then we tried to cover as much of the city as we could so that people would feel like they understood a little bit about what LA offers.
Kate, your work on the book didn't cease after you stepped in to help with the photography. What are you doing now to help your mom?
That's right. I am helping with the marketing angle of the Los Angeles classic desserts and sort of, you know, reaching out to the restaurants that are featured in the book and making sure that the restaurant owners and the chefs have the book in their possession to either sell through their store or their restaurant or their bakery. And also I manage the social marketing for the books. That's the stuff that I am probably best at, I think. And so that's where I took the reins and tried to go with it.
What has the reaction been? So you had these reluctant participants at first. So what's happened since? Do you have any enthusiastic folks that are just thrilled finally that they're in this beautiful book?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
I think so. We were in LA last week, or 2 weeks ago, rather, and we set up a few appointments to just go and stop in some of these bakeries. And we stopped in and saw Jane Lockhart at Sweet Lady Jane, and she was just floored at how beautiful her raspberry cheesecake came out and was thrilled to have it on the back cover and immediately wanted some copies. And so we have copies in both of her locations in Santa Monica and Hollywood. And then, you know, I think that it's a stunningly beautiful book. So I think everyone's really thrilled.
Yeah, it is pretty. And the desserts are really scrumptious.
So the photographs are so beautiful. And I understand that there's another family connection that has to do with the photography.
That's right. My oldest daughter, Allison Bauer Meyerson, who lives in L.A., and actually study photography and does a lot of photo shooting and staging. She was the photographer for the book. And Kate Bauer.
Kate, no, you yes. were involved?
I was involved. I did some of the PR and marketing for the book, and I did a little bit of extra sidebar photography, the photography that shoots sort of the ambiance or the outside of the establishment, the restaurant or the bakery or deli or what have you. And then my older sister, the sister in between Allie and I, Leah Bauer, helped Mom figure out ways to get in touch with some of these chefs. She's very good at talking to people and getting what she wants.
So all three daughters were involved.
Yes.
And then I hear the grandkids played a part too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, of course, Poppy, one of the granddaughters, was living with me at the time, and she was actually spent a lot of time in the kitchen with me.
That must have been fun.
And the two grandsons, who were much smaller at the time, all three actually were wonderful tasters.
Oh, I bet.
So we would get reactions right away. They were all favorable, I will say, but yeah, they were great at testing the product once it came in.
Well, you mentioned that on occasion they didn't wait long enough before they tested the product. Was that ever a problem in photography?
Sure.
It was. With the banana cake, right?
Yeah. You have to adjust the photo shot to what you have available.
And once there's a big bite taken out, yes, that can make a difference.
Yeah, you're not going to shoot the whole cake at that point. It's going to be a slice.
It must have been so wonderful turning this book, this first project of yours, into a family endeavor.
Oh, it is, Poppy. I think life is that way. Anytime you can have a project that's fun, it's delicious, and you can involve your family and share not only the experience, but the results. What could be better than that?
Well, it was such a pleasure to have this opportunity to bring the mother-daughter team, at least one of the daughters, into the studio. Wish they could have all been here with us.
Thanks, Poppy.
Thank you, Poppy.
Kate and Grace Bauer and Los Angeles Classic Dessert.
Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, Sucre chef Tarek Hanna fills us with sweet talk just in time for Christmas.
So the study of crystallization, which is a very new study considering, is probably one of the most dynamic elements of what makes the structure of chocolate good or bad. So if you have a nice piece of chocolate that's shiny, you break it, it snaps. You put it in your mouth, it melts and it's not granular. That's because you have great crystallization.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Leitzegan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.